This week on the BioAg World Show, we talk about value-based design, chatbots, and why software development is getting harder. This week's show is sponsored by Teacup AdWords and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, a podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name's Paul BOAG, and amazingly, Andy Clark has actually turned up this week. Nice of you to bother.
Well, you know, I had better things to do last week, you know, I had to wash my hair.
Rub in the fact that you still got hair. That's nice, thanks. No,
genuinely, I buggered up the time difference, because I forgot. You know, I forgot whether it was like 9 hours or 10 hours or whatever. And sadly, I missed it. But, you know, you talk to yourself like normal. So it just like being
is
at
this
home.
Is true?
Yeah. Just like being at home. Did you laugh is at your own joke at the end?
Well, of course. It was the only way of being sure of intelligent conversation, to be honest.
Did you do the fantasy joke?
The fantasy joke? Yes, I did.
Yep.
What was wrong with that? That was a good joke.
No, actually, it was a very, very good joke, actually. It was one of the better ones.
Yeah.
It's the way you tell them.
So, how long do I have to put up with this misery of time zones and bad connections and crap like that? When are you going to get your ass back to a decent country? I mean, the weather here is phenomenal at the moment.
Well, I know there's been people... Do you know Al Power? Lovely Al Power?
Yes, I know of him.
Yes, lovely fella. I follow him and his wife, Zoe, on Instagram, and they've been posting some lovely, lovely pictures of the sun and the sky and all of that stuff. And Mr. Hicks had a good... It was Father's Day this week, apparently.
Yes.
So in the UK... it's a different Father's Day here. We have a different one. Perhaps for, you know, just in case you have a different father. I don't know. And
Hang on a minute. I don't like the way you started referring to we... Have you gone native already?
Well, I suppose so, yes. So, I've been vicariously living the UK summer through John Hicks and Al Power and you and various other people that I follow on Instagram.
So what's the weather like with you at the moment, temperature-wise?
It's winter, so it's been grey and cold and it's been about 14 degrees and it's been rainy. There's been a bit of low pressure off the coast of the Tasman Sea. And so, yes, therefore, it's been wet and rainy. But it is winter here, so, you know, I mustn't grumble. But to answer your question about whether I'm coming back to Theresa May's kingdom, not anytime soon is the honest answer.
Oh, right. What happened to the 6 months thing then?
Well, the 6 month thing came and I realised that I was enjoying it way too much for it just to be a 6 month thing. This is the thing, right? This is the thing that you will not be able to understand. The listeners will have no comprehension about how this has possibly happened. But they think I'm actually doing quite a good job. So,
yeah,
they offered me a job and I decided that, yeah, I'm going to take it. So I'm going to stay in Australia, in Sydney, for the foreseeable future.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you know, they are a very long way away from civilization. So I imagine their choice of, you know, designers, developers must be fairly limited. So, you know, you end up scraping the barrel. I mean, the people that are there are convicts and, you know, the kind of rejects from society. So yeah, it makes sense, really, that you managed to get a job there. Well done.
I am the Web's Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen.
What does that even mean?
Well, when was the last time you saw Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen on TV in the UK? Apart from reruns of Changing Rooms from the 1980s. When was the last time? You don't see him. Oh, you don't see him at all. But he's on telly here. He's rekindled his career in Australia. He's got a new lease of life. Boy George, the same. Boy George is on The Voice here because he got kicked off The Voice in the UK. So basically... old has-beens come to Australia, and here I am.
So I've probably got another, what, 5 years?
Five years and you'll be here, yeah.
Okay, good to know.
You'll be here. It's like a kangaroo sanctuary for old British web designers.
We could start a seniors home. I'm sure we talked about that before once, a web designer's retirement home.
Yes, we did. And it would be somewhere nice and warm, obviously. But yes, I am staying in Australia.
Oh, well, congratulations. I'm very pleased for you or something. I'm deeply envious, if I'm honest.
I am going to be chief colouring in officer.
Well done. Do you get like a gold plated box of crayons?
No, they haven't given me that yet. Maybe I should. Maybe that's what you get after 50 years in the business.
Yeah, I was going to say.
A gold box of crayons.
Yeah. I wonder whether you got it when you retire instead of a gold watch.
No. So what do they call them? Golden hello? Which is not at all like a golden shower. Anyway, I was going to say,
it sounded like something a bit dodgy, didn't it?
We ought to talk about value-based design is what we ought to talk about.
Yeah, we ought to, from someone who actually knows what they're doing. Now, do you know this guy?
No, I don't know this guy.
Okay. So I'm trying to work out how to say his surname. Disbato?
Disbato, I would say, yeah. Disbato.
Yeah. So this is Nick Disbato, and we're going to go with that. I'm sorry, Nick, if we've just absolutely ruined your name. Go par with the course if you're going to be on this show. So he's a designer and a writer from Chicago who does a lot of A-B testing on online businesses. So he's got a whole load of different people he works for. He's written a small book about interaction design and does loads of really cool stuff. You can find out more about him at draft.nu. Now, I'm really interested to hear Andy's comments on this one. Because Nick is talking about value-based design and how we need to measure the economic value of our design. And I think it'll be interesting to hear what Andy has to say on this subject, because I've heard him say some different things on this. So let's see what Nick has to say for himself.
Hi there, I'm Nick DeSabato. I'm a designer and writer from Chicago. Recently, I saw two blog posts in the middle of April that came out from two different people that talked about kind of the same topic. And they were pretty, you know, well-known people. One of them is Jared Spool, who runs UIE, and he's an extremely famous speaker and author across the world. And he wrote about how to justify the value of design in an organization. And then 4 days later, on April 17th, Julie Shuo, who's the VP of product at Facebook, she wrote a blog post on Medium about how design often feels like an uphill battle in an organization and that the fundamental issue is that you haven't proven the value. And I must admit, I'm surprised that design hasn't proven its value in 2017, because by this point, you have dozens of organizations. I mean, Apple's the biggest one, but you also look at Airbnb. All their co-founders, I believe, are designers. You have, dozens and dozens of organizations base themselves on having good quality design, both graphic and UX, very good design research patterns. If you look at an organization like Uber, they've redesigned their application like 4 or 5 times and done wholesale refactors of them each time. And yet, organizations are still suspicious of what designers can actually bring to the table. I think the onus on this is mostly on designers. We don't do a very good job proving our value. We either came from art school or we fell into the field from some sort of other profession. And in neither of those circumstances are you actually taught about the business ramifications of design decisions. So this is going to be a very brief summary of how I do that in my own design practice and how you can do that in an organization of any size. So the number one thing that you need to be thinking about when you're proposing a way to calculate the value of design is by measuring it. And the best way to measure it, in my experience, is by taking a look at analytics. Now, Google Analytics is one of the worst applications of all time. It's a Byzantine horror. I get it. I know. But there are a couple things you can do if you just kind of go step by step through it that will help you prepare an analytics install effectively and focus on the right things. Why would you want to do this? The goal is to connect a design decision to a corresponding economic impact within the organization. You are there to bring more value than, frankly, you cost, right? So you have you have a salary, you have benefits, you maybe have square footage in the office, you maybe have a laptop that they're giving you or something like that, And you need a way to actually prove that you belong there, right? Otherwise, people aren't going to believe that design has any value, and you're going to be struggling to have these sorts of conversations. So with that in mind, the two things that you should be calculating in Google Analytics are revenue and conversion rate. Depending on what business you have, obviously I'm going very, very broad with this, you should probably have a revenue and a conversion rate. So on the thank you page, you add basically a couple lines of JavaScript that tell Google Analytics how much revenue this person made. If it's an online store, something like that, it's usually called e-commerce analytics. And the goal there is to calculate the average revenue per user. So if you have, 1 million people coming in and 100,000 of them are buying, and they're all buying the same $20 product, then it's $2 million per million users, so you have a $2 average revenue per user. It's a very simplistic calculation. Correspondingly, if it's 100,000 people, it's a 10% conversion rate. Pretty high conversion rate. It's not bad. But you want both of those numbers to go up. So you want the average order value to go up. People should be buying more stuff. You want the conversion rate overall to go up. And you want the overall revenue for the business to go up, because if you have a higher conversion rate, but you have lower revenue, then that's not so good either, right? There are a lot of ways that you can do this. You end up creating all of these goals, and then you're doing design. You're listening to your customers, seeing what it is that actually motivates them to buy, and in a non-skeezy, non-manipulating way, make it easier for them to buy the things that you're selling. So that partly involves promoting the value of your product. That partly involves making it easier from a usability standpoint. So a lot of my work usually involves cutting out unnecessary elements, simplifying unusable forms, removing extraneous form fields, improving page load time, improving mobile, which is always a perennial issue. And in doing all of those things, usually the conversion rate goes up, because it is easier for people to load pages if they're on the subway or something like that, and it's very hard for them to get on a connection. Then they can actually download a faster page. Makes more sense. So doing all of those things, you've configured conversion rate as a goal. You configure revenue as a goal. You create maybe a funnel from one page to the next. If you're running a software business or something, it could go home, pricing, sign up, then the beginning of an onboarding process. And once you have all of those things prepared, the next thing that you do is research. So you're continuing to pay attention to analytics. Maybe there's geographic or demographic things that are interesting. Maybe traffic sources are being a huge influence on your funnel. You also run heat and scroll maps to see where people are clicking, where people are scrolling, where they are not clicking, how far they are not scrolling. You can run surveys on people, both post-purchase. So on the thank you page, write a single form field that was like, is there anything that held you back from purchasing today? Or how did you feel about our checkout process today? And just one form blank, and you'll get a lot of interesting things to be mining. These are all important because research is obviously a fundamental component of any design process. And so you want to be continually listening to your customers and building it in as kind of a holistic capacity of the organization. So you're saying, okay, well, it's not just me sitting in Photoshop doing design every day. It's me listening to these customers and figuring out how to synthesize that into design. This sounds more like a data-driven version of what an organization like IDEO or Cooper or Adaptive Path would do, which are all pretty well-known in the design field. They spend most of their time doing field work with existing participants or customers, and they just spend a lot of time sitting and listening and researching. And then they go back and they try and translate that into something that has a positive upside for the business. In this case, you're sitting there and looking at what people are doing in analytics or in surveys. You might even want to recruit people for interviews on the phone, or go to a website like usertesting.com and do usability tests or whatever have you. And you're trying to do that in a way that has a palpable economic upside for the business. So that results in, okay, well, where are we leaking revenue here? Well, a lot of people are dropping off the checkout form right here. That's bad. Let's try and figure out a way to improve that. I can't tell you how many times I've encountered forms that there was like one busted field in it, or what didn't have the right mobile keyboard, or it wasn't doing validation correctly, and it was costing the business like a 5% bump on their conversion rate. It's worth getting a developer on that to fix it, right? So in this way, you can justify design decisions and focus critique around what value it might have for the business. So if it's something that happens to be high risk, like you're cutting out billing address from a form, which might be a lot of development effort or might be very hard to justify from a risk standpoint or a fraud standpoint or whatever have you, you can maybe cite other studies. You can maybe run an A-B test or something like that that determines, okay, well, we're going to make this much money by actually cutting this out. So therefore, it's worth it to us. Having that sort of database justification is very, very good for focusing critique. It's great for helping people understand why it is we're actually trying to make these sorts of design decisions. And it also kind of defangs the what's called the HIPPO, or the highest paid person's opinion. So if it's the CEO recommending something that just sounds gobsmackingly ill-advised, you can go back and say, well, the research doesn't support it. And that way it makes the suggestions and critique a little bit more egalitarian and focused and rational. With that in mind, if you don't have the traffic necessary for A-B testing, you can still measure step function changes in Google Analytics. So if you have analytics, as I mentioned before, when you hit a redesign, you can add what's called an annotation in Google Analytics that says, okay, well, on this date, we launched the redesign. And then you can say, okay, well, we looked back, and here's the history of all design decisions that we launched to the site. And if you can integrate Google Analytics annotations with any sort of, like, Git pushes to the actual, like, marketing pages of your site or the front end of your site or whatever have you, you can say, okay, well, we did this, this, and this on these dates, and the conversion rate has been going steadily up ever since. This allows you to go back and look at the impact of your work, and it also keeps you focused and accountable to that work, right? Because if you're focused on the conversion rate and your presence there and people taking you seriously is based on the conversion rate, it's like operating on a deadline, right? If you program, you know, just for fun, it's great, but you become a very good programmer by programming in a more stressful environment on deadline. The same as design, right? So if you are designing so that you can improve the conversion rate, suddenly very few other things matter. The goal is to do this in a way that is ethical and still, you know, upholding the values of design that you have come to hold so dearly to yourself. I don't advocate any sort of dark patterns or any sort of negative, you know, manipulation of the customer. I don't think that makes any sense, and it's not the kind of line of work that I ever wanted to get into. But the goal is to listen to your customers and try and create something that meets their needs, right? It also allows you to do this in kind of a more continuous way. So you can continue researching. You know, you're never done running heat maps on things. You're never done surveying people post-purchase, or maybe every quarter you survey all previous customers, or you ask them for reviews after they've received the product a few days later. You're creating a weekly research cadence where you're gaining more data, more insight, and trying to figure out a way to act on it. This works well for anybody as a full-time employee. It also works really well if you're a consultant or an independent worker and you want to go on an ongoing retainer. So you might be hired to redesign the site as an agency. But then a very good way to continue working with a client is not to find other places where you can redesign, but find ways to optimize the design that you've already created and recognize that you may not have gotten it fully right the first time, but you're already fixing a lot of major problems ahead of time. So that's it on the economic impact of design. I hope that this was useful for you.
Okay, so that was Nick. Andy, what did you think?
Yeah, I've got to be honest, haven't I? This is absolutely not the approach to design or the type of design that fascinates me at all. I mean, let's not to say that it isn't valuable, because, you know, design is there to solve a purpose in general. And I'm not suggesting that it isn't valuable or it's not... you know, every design can benefit from various different types of input. You know, you can't design something in isolation. It isn't about, you know, one person's vision of a thing. You know, the stuff that I'm working on right now, you know, I have a very strong idea about how we should accomplish something, but that something has to be aligned to the strategic goals of the company. Mm-hmm. But I get incredibly frustrated when, you know, some people, Kenneth Bowles, think that this aspect of design is all that matters. And the idea that, you know, you should base your design decisions on what people do rather than what you necessarily are trying to get from them, I find difficult. I mean, you know, I'm in a business where, you know, we design products, and the idea that somebody needs to use these products is obviously, you know, incredibly important. If they don't use the product and they can't use the product, then we don't make any money. You know, they're not going to stay as customers. But the idea that that kind of metric is the only aspect of design that that matters to people is incredibly frustrating. And, you know, I'm not saying that this is bad, obviously, but, you know, we need to balance it with, you know, he mentions graphic design at the beginning of the talk. You know, good graphic design, design with personality, as we're going to hear in a talk in a minute, is as important as validating design decisions based on data.
I mean, this is a tricky one for me, okay? Because I probably fall somewhere between the two of you, okay? I totally agree with Nick, and I think there was a lot that he said that I thought was very valuable. So for a start, he talked about design needs to bring more economic value than it costs, right? And that, to me, is the difference between art and design. So it does need to provide a return on investment to it. But I think the line there is there's different ways of doing that. Okay. So I think someone like yourself, Andy, you do a lot of things intuitively, based on years of experience that provides that economic value. Okay. And there isn't necessarily a need for you to measure every single element and every single thing that's going on. But I think there is real value in doing that measurement. And the reason, one of the things that I thought provided real value, which is something that you picked up on as well, and I'm going to steal one of your points in your notes, is it's a great way of defanging the highest paid person in the room. It's a great way of making the business case for what you have done. So it's not saying that all of your design should be led and dictated by the numbers, but it's a good way to either validate your design or alternatively to boost the case for your design, which I guess is the same thing, really. Yeah. But I think there's another really important aspect in it is Nick was focusing very much on e-commerce sites and that kind of thing, and many of the sites that I work on are not e-commerce sites. They've got other calls to action. So sometimes you need to be a little bit more broad in what metrics you're measuring. And even in his situation, he talked about using non-sleazy manipulative methods, and that it was really important not to do that. But if all you are measuring is the economic return on investment, then you are inevitably going to fall into the world of sleazy manipulative methodologies to get there, dark patterns and that kind of stuff. So I think it's about measuring the right things. You know, you do need to measure things like delight, customer satisfaction, those kinds of metrics, as well as the purely economic one. If you're trying to build a long-term business, you know, if you're not, if you're just trying to win a quick buck and screw a load of people over in the short term, by all means, just focus on getting that conversion as quickly as possible. But if you're building a long-term business that wants repeat customers and that kind of thing, you've got to think more broadly than just conversion rates and those kinds of metrics. And to be honest, I think Nick was saying that. He was just trying to introduce the subject. So I actually think it's a balance, really, isn't it? It's like anything.
It's absolutely a balance. And I think that the pendulum has swung a long way in the kind of metrics UX area of design over the last couple of years. And the example that I like to use is toothpaste. You know, people keep banging on about digital products, you know, as if they're like real products, as if it's a tube of toothpaste. You know, how efficient is the tube of toothpaste? Do you remember when the tube of toothpaste used to be made of metal? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And you had to roll up the end to get the last bit of the... Not an efficient tube of toothpaste. The bloody thing used to split down the seam and you get toothpaste all over your bag or your toilet bag or something. Not a great tube of toothpaste. And you'd lose the cap because the cap wasn't one of those kind of, you know, fixed in plastic caps. It was like a screw-on cap. Not a great thing. So we've obviously improved on the tube of toothpaste, and that's mm-hmm. product design. But that's not what I do. I couldn't give a monkeys about the tube of toothpaste and about designing it, because that's what somebody else does. That's, you know, if people are fascinated by making tube of toothpaste, you know, excellent. But what I'm interested in is why you buy Colgate rather than McLean's. You know, what makes you pick up Aquafresh on the chemist or the supermarket shelf? And that's the aspect of design that I deal with. So, you know, there needs to be room for everything.
But there is overlap in those areas, because part of the reason why someone would have chosen, you know, Colgate over McLean's at one point was because, oh, Colgate have come up with these great new plastic, tubes, which don't split. So for a while, that product design gave them a competitive advantage that did drive sales. So it does kind of overlap with the area that you're interested in. So it's not a black and white thing. And I think particularly at the moment with user experience, you know, user experience is becoming a primary driver for many sales. You know, people want the easiest to use experience. So I think of it like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So, you know, the kind of stuff that, you know, I maybe spend a lot of time on, Nick spends a lot of time on, even Kenneth Bowles spends a lot of time on, is the more base of that pyramid, is the fundamentals, okay? You know, of is it usable? Is it accessible? Does it meet my base needs? You're looking at the topper end of the spectrum, at the emotional elements of it and the self-actualization and those kinds of parts of it. So it's all part of the same kind of pyramid. We're just looking at different parts. That's how I kind of view it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, I'm working with product designers every day that want to know about, you know, interactions, and they want to know about, you know, what the colours that we're choosing means for discoverability and all of that kind of stuff. Brilliant. Love those guys. Not what I do for a living.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what it comes down to. And I think it's good. It's kind of, it's nice that there are people focusing on different parts of the experience. And by the way, just before we move on to the sponsor, because we really should, we've spent far too long on this, I do just want to say, you use toothpaste as an analogy. I use Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I think that makes me cleverer. Right, let's talk about our first sponsor. All more pretentious, probably, is the truth. So we've just heard about value-based design. So who better to talk about at this point than Full Story?
Tell us about Full Story, Paul.
I really like Full Story. So Full Story is a tool I use all the time. And I think it's my personal opinion is it's the best analytics tool out there for measuring what's going on in your site and knowing how users are responding to it. So they asked me this week to share my own thoughts about the platform. So they gave me no talking points at all. They just say, you say whatever you want to about it. So instead of doing that, what I want to do is just read you something from our Slack channel this week, because somebody happened to give this product a go and they were giving a bit of feedback on it. So this is straight from the Slack channel, all right? Full Story actually needs very little configuration to test anything. Pasting in some JS into the head is basically it. It's a broad spectrum tool that monitors everything that you don't exclude using CSS selectors. Okay, this is the really key bit. This is the bit that I think says it all. From a 2-hour playing around that I wasn't asked to do or authorized for, I got evidence for 12 problems I've mentioned to others that I can now replay to them and say, it's not just in my head. that, for example, even repeat users are leaving the site multiple times or unsure of how to reach the cart despite the notifications, right? So for me, that says it all and almost goes back to what we were talking about previously. The area that I really like analytics in is that ability to back up what you know is true. The evidence that, you know, it's evidence for what you've already been banging on about and haven't been able to convince people of. So definitely check that out. You can sign up today and see if it provides you with the same kind of values as it did the guy in our Slack channel. You'll get a month for free of their pro account. Don't worry, you don't need to give your credit card over. So, you know, they're not going to start charging you at the end of the month. If you get to the end of the month and you want to pay, then that's great and you get the full suite of stuff. If you don't want to pay, then you still get the full suite of stuff, but they only record 1,000 sessions per month. But to be honest, 1,000 sessions per month is often enough to get, you know, an idea of the kind of problems that are on your site. So there's no reason not to. You can find out more about them, sign up, all the rest of it by going to fullstory.com/BOAG, BOAG. Okay. So cool. Next up, we come to designing personality in chatbots, which is a really interesting subject. This is from Mike. I've no idea. I'm not even going to try.
You're rubbish with names, aren't you? Is it Youngbloat?
Youngbloat? Maybe. Youngbloat? I don't know. So I am. I'm terrible. It strikes fear into me. It's Mike. That's who it is. It's Mike from Deeson. So he's the head of user experience at a digital agency called Deeson, where he uses open source technologies with in-house UX design and development teams, and he's built solutions for clients such as Robbie Williams, National Army Museum, and the brewery Shepherd's, whatever that is, Neem. Is that a thing? Should I recognise that name? Anyway, I'd recognise Robbie Williams.
I'd like to hear you commentate on a World Cup football game at some point. This would be hilarious.
No, this is terrible. I don't know what it is. It just creates fear in me.
Suriname versus Nigeria. There you go. You'd be great at that.
Okay, thanks. So anyway, Mike wants you to know that they're looking to hire people, which is good. So you can go to their website, which is deeson.co.uk, if you want to find out more about their job opportunities. Right, but actually, none of that matters. What we're really interested in is what Mike has got to say about chatbots. So let's listen to his talk.
What I wanted to talk about today was chatbots. And the reason I wanted to talk about them is because, as a lot of people are, I was quite a skeptic for quite a while. We've been doing a lot of work with them, but I kind of saw them as a bit of a gimmick. And I couldn't really see the purpose for them. And then my creative director sent me one to try out. It was the Humans bot that Channel 4 created to support the marketing of their TV drama Humans. Humans is a show about synthetic humans. And the premise of this bot is that you're contacting their support staff because your synthetic human has gone wrong. The reason this bot changed my mind about bots is because it was really engaging. Previously, I've spoken with many chatbots when testing them and got bored very quickly. But with this bot, I found myself drawn into the conversation. I found almost building a bit of connection with it. The narrative is designed to try and build a bit of an emotional connection with you. It uses imagery and names of the support staff to give them a bit more human quality. It tells jokes. It shows emotion. It shows that it's scared at times. It shows that it's funny at times. And it shows a lot of human qualities. The chat makes you build a connection with this bot, just as when you're watching a TV series, you build a bit of a connection with the lead character or another character. It's the same premise. And that's what I found really interesting about talking to this particular bot, and the way that it was used as a marketing campaign to engage someone worked really well. I think chatbots have some purpose, and one purpose they can really excel at is to support marketing campaigns. This was only a 15 to 30 minute chat overall, but it was really engaging. Another example of using a chatbot as a to support a kind of campaign is one that Charity Water created in partnership with a company called Lockeye. So Charity Water are a water charity. So they map the journey that a lot of young African children take every day to collect water for their families. And it turned out to be roughly a 2.5 hour walk to and from the water source back to their village. And what the bot does is it encourages you to go for a 2.5 hour walk, but engage with the bot as you do. And as you go for your walk, Yeshi, which is the girl's name, tells you about her walk, and you can kind of get an idea of what it's really like. And it builds that emotional engagement with the charity much better than a donate button or an article does, because you're actually living what's going on. And during that walk, she asks you kind of, where are you from? And you say, oh, I'm from London. And she says, oh, send me a photo. So you can take a photo and it sends it over. And she says, wow, our worlds are so different. And it's these kind of things that make these bots more human and more real that will engage people. So I was trying to think afterwards about what it was. How could I summarise what it was that made the difference with those bots? And I think it comes down to one thing, which is personality. So I started with the thought, what is personality? And I asked a few people, and I got words like memorable, impactful. It's what makes us unique and different. It's our character, our thoughts and our feelings. And it comes out in our behaviours, our actions, and the interactions we have with each other. I also looked up some internet definitions. And the two that I liked best were, it's the combination of characteristics or qualities that form an individual's distinctive character, and the quality or fact of a person as distinct from a thing. And when we think about chatbots, and if we want to design a chatbot, we want it to be like engaging with more than a thing. So that second one, the quality or fact of being a person as distinct from a thing, really helps. And that kind of confirmed that personality is the thing that will make our chatbot stand out. And with hundreds of them out there at the moment, if you don't have personality in your chatbot, it's not going to stand out from the crowd. You're not first to market anymore. A guy called Aaron Walters wrote a book, Designing for Emotion. And in a presentation he gave, he looked at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and drew up his own based on designing for personality and emotion. The bottom three layers, functional, reliable, usable, are things that if we're designing chatbots, they have to have those, otherwise they're no use to anyone. But the top layer, and the one that's really going to differentiate us from competition, is the personality layer, the thing that makes it pleasurable to use. And if we think about more traditional apps and websites, and we think about where they have personality and where they trigger emotion, it's through fun, pleasurable things. So the MailChimp monkey sweating when you're about to send the email. Charity websites use imagery to trigger emotion. It's this personality that helps differentiate and helps us connect on an emotional level with our users. So personality speaks to people and emotionally engages your audience. Traditionally in web design, personality has come out through user interface design and the functionality. When we think about chatbots, it's actually what the bot says or thinks and what the bot does, which can be likened to how you might describe it in a human, what you say or think or what you do. So I think in conversational UI, personality is the new UX. So how do we design for personality? The good news is that we already do design for personality. So in web design and app design, as I said earlier, we're thinking about what neat little features, what quirks can we put into our designs that will trigger emotional reactions in our users. And I think a lot of the tools that we use in user experience and web design are just as applicable for chatbots. We just use them in a slightly different way. Take personas, for example. A persona currently, or the way we use them in web design, represents a user of our audience so that we can design for them. But we can have a bit more fun with chatbots. We get to design the persona from scratch. Who do we want our chatbot to be? What mannerisms do we want it to have? What quirks does it have? What positive and negative personality traits does it have? We can think about questions like, if my bot was a celebrity, who would it be? If it was a TV personality, who would it be? And we can draw all this together into a persona, which describes our chatbot's personality. Following on from that, once we've decided what type of person it is, we need to think about how it talks. If I was to write down three things said by some of your close friends on paper, you would probably be able to tell which one was said by which of your friends. And the reason is because we all talk slightly differently. We all have slightly different mannerisms, slightly different ways of saying things. And to make it engaging, we need our chatbot to have its own voice as well. So once we have a persona for it, we can start thinking about the tone of voice. Is it jovial? Is it very serious? Is it aggressive? We can start to draw up keywords of how we want our bot to behave. A challenge with creating personality for chatbots is the visual aspect. It's a different type of design because we no longer have control over the visual design. People are using these things in Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp. But the humans chatbot that I used subtly used imagery and emojis, and this gave it personality. As I kind of mentioned earlier, that when you first start the chat, you get to choose who you want to talk to, and each support staff has an image and a name, which gives them a bit more personality. It makes you feel like you're talking to someone, not a robot. It's a really interesting challenge we have as designers for how we design chatbots. And I've only really touched the surface because beyond this, you then have to design the narrative itself, which is a huge challenge. But before jumping into the narrative, it's really important to think about who your chatbot's going to be, what personality it's going to have, and how that's going to engage your audiences. Because without a personality, your chatbot will be just a robot with a bland voice, and people will not engage with it, will not connect with it. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so that was Mike. I really enjoyed his. Chatbots have become a bit of a thing for me, if I'm honest, recently. I was just as cynical as him, but I've come at it from a different angle. That for me, when I was initially cynical about chatbots, I was thinking about Siri and things like that, those open-ended chatbots where you can ask them anything, right? So I always used to compare it because I'm old like you. Do you remember when we used to, did you have a ZX Spectrum or a Commodore 64?
No. I was already working down the pit when those things came out.
So with those, there were games, there was one game I used to play a lot called The Hobbit, right? And it was a text-based adventure game. And in The Hobbit, you used to have to type in commands, you know, if you wanted to go east or, you know, pick up a hammer or something. And you spent half your time trying to guess the terminology that the programmer had entered into the text-based adventure game. So is it go west, or is it travel west, or is it travel to the left, or, you know, what is the combination that they want? And that, to me, felt like what chatbots were. You know, you have to guess what terminology they use. And that just didn't seem like a good user experience. But then I started to see a different type of chatbot. And these were more like the choose your own adventure books. Well, you must remember those.
No, I don't remember those. We didn't have those in the north.
Right. Well, choose your own adventure books were basically you had a book and you got to the end of a page. And you were given a choice. You could do this or you can do this. If you do the thing A, you turn to page 18. thing B, turn to page 28. And you kind of travel through the story like that. So I started to see a lot of chatbots like that. And they worked a lot better. But anyway, that's what got me into chatbots. And that is not what Mike is talking about. He's talking about the emotional connection. And I think the advice that he was giving and the stuff he was sharing really applies to any writing for the web, because I think personally most writing for the web really lacks personality and sucks at it.
I think
all that chatbots are really doing is bringing to the fore a lack of investment organizations are making in their written content. And it still blows my mind to this day that people will pay a fortune for a content management system but won't pay a penny for what goes in it, because people think they can all write, which is bollocks.
No, I know.
Anyway, what did you think of it, Andy?
I would absolutely, if you're listening, Mike, I would really like to hear or see an expanded version of this talk, because it's actually one of the favorite ones that I've heard recently. Because he's talking about something which is, you know, very much up my alley, which is thinking about giving designs personality. And the idea, I mean, and people will say, yes, but, you know, the UX matters and it's about, but, you know, do you know what? It's about communicating information effectively, getting people to understand a message. And, you know, I loved the idea of somebody taking a walk for, what was it, 2.5 kilometers or something,
yeah,
interacting with this bot and comparing, you know, your experience doing a walk with the girl from Africa who's doing a walk to collect water and that kind of thing. And that's just, you know, there's so much kind of personality and opportunity for being creative there. But that's not just for creativity's sake. It's because it's communicating the message. It's getting a deeper understanding of what that person's, you know, thinking and experiencing and everything else. So it's brilliant. I mean, I haven't really had any experience with chatbots at all. I don't think ever. I don't think it's not anything that's kind of, you know, crossed my radar. But I just really love the idea that people are thinking about this as kind of another medium for creativity. You know, the other one that he mentioned from Channel 4, you know, I can imagine one of my favorite ad campaigns is the meerkat, you know, the compare the meerkat thing. It's gone off a little bit recently, but I absolutely loved that whole kind of Alexander Orloff, the meerkat in comparethemeerkat.com. And I remember when that campaign started, you could actually talk to Alexander on Twitter. And, you know, he'd respond in the character, and it was like a brilliant, absolutely brilliant kind of, you know, bit of advertising. And, you know, I can imagine chatbots being used for that kind of stuff. And again, it's, you know, it's not just there for, you know, for designer's sake. It's there because it's helping people to communicate a brand message. I love it. Got to disagree with Mike on a little bit, though, when he's talking about the fact that, you know, we already design personality into web design. You know, in my experience, quite the bloody opposite, to be honest. I mean, you know, I think that most clients and, you know, and a hell of a lot of UX designers, they're doing everything that they possibly can to kind of eradicate any personality in a design, you know, because they're just so afraid of taking any risks. So, you know, it's one of the reasons why all, you know, so many websites look the bloody same. So I don't think that, you know, people have got this right at all in terms of web design. And, you know, you made the point earlier on about copy. That's, you know, that's another aspect where we should be really thinking about the message. You know, what are we trying to communicate? What's the best words to use? What's the best medium to use? How can we kind of art direct all of this kind of stuff and bring people into the story that we're telling? This kind of opened my eyes to what some of the stuff that we, you know, could be doing with things like chatbots. And I'm definitely going to be looking at how we can use, you know, something similar at work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a great fan of chatbots. I think there's so much that could be done. Okay, let's move on to our second sponsor, and then we'll get into our final talk.
Second sponsor is
Teacup Analytics. So Teacup Analytics makes is a great suite of all kinds of really wonderful tools. But the one tool that I want to focus on this week is their AdWords tool, which makes dealing with AdWords effortless. So you can run ad campaigns in Google AdWords in a much simpler way, because let's face it, running AdWords campaigns can be a real headache, can't they? You've got to do keyword research, you've got to set up your campaign structure, you need to create your ad copy, then your landing page has to be made and it has to be relevant. Then you've got to do bid management and optimization, and it takes hours of your time each week. So Teacup's new tool makes AdWords effortless, and basically it's really, really simple. So it starts by helping you create the right keywords. So all it does, all you have to do is answer a few short, simple questions, right? And then Teacup creates both the ads and relevant unique landing pages and the keywords all based on those few simple questions. And once the campaign is up and running, Teacup then handles your bid optimization, adding negative keywords, testing ad copy, and a lot more. It is absolute witchcraft, I tell you. It's a really weird thing to watch. So if you want to try out the beta, because they're currently looking for beta testers, then you can sign up. And they really, when they say beta testers, they really mean it. They want your ideas. They want your feedback. That was the one thing last time that they advertised on the show they absolutely loved, was the fact that you actively engaged with them as a community and you gave them loads of great suggestions. And that's what they're after again. So they're offering a limited invitation access to the tool. If you want that and you want to provide some feedback, then you can sign up to get early access by going to teacupanalytics.com/AdWords. Okay, cool. Right. We come on to our last talk, which is Peter Pilgrim, which I just think is an awesome name. And he's talking about software development and how hard it can be these days, and especially he really is getting into legacy a lot and dealing with legacy systems. So here's Peter's talk.
Hi, I'm Peter Pilgrim. I'm going to talk to you about why our software is so hard, or why is it going to be so hard in the future? Why is software getting ever more so harder to write and build, and why are we getting frustrated with it? I guess I am frustrated with the software that we are constantly building and writing. And the problem is that no matter what innovations we build around the process of constructing software, it never seems satisfying to both end user, development, users, testers. There's always something that we have to do to get the even further into the software process, or to get a reasonable result. We've tried Agile and in the way that the minimal value release, the MVR, or the minimum value product. We try to build these kind of fine-tune our process of building applications with test-driven development and peer programming, code reviews, and we still don't get the answer of efficient, consistent software. And it always takes longer and longer to actually build the software in the first place. And I think the problem is that the majority of us, unless you work in a startup, as developers, we're building against legacy software libraries or packages. I'd like to call these giant balls of wax. As you can imagine, a giant ball of wax is actually disgusting and messy. Some of these applications, and I've witnessed a fair degree, have, say, like 500,000 lines of code in I've seen a lot. I've seen Fortran 77 20 odd years ago, which has nothing to do with object oriented programming, and even precede structured function structured program with methods and procedures. I've seen Fortran with go-tos, and people have been stuck with it. So that's the general worry, is that, okay, I haven't explained that correctly. The general worry is that it's getting harder and harder to chip away at this mountainous ball of wax, so much so that I think companies are going to find themselves in grave danger. I suspect this is even hitting the news, although I cannot prove it. The recent failure to update software in the NHS, VisiV, an operating system, Windows 95, and then the actual fallout of British Airways, that a data surge destroyed their data center. Okay, that's speculative, so I wouldn't necessarily add that. But the point is that our software is failing because of the technology and also the people that we want to maintain it. If you invest in a software platform or some kind of architecture, I can pretty much say there's no such thing as a silver bullet 100% architecture that means that your applications are going to be sustainable for the next 20 odd years. Certainly programming languages can last that long, but because we are buffeted by trends such as technology, JavaScript or Java, C#, it's actually the libraries around these programming languages and actually the concept of programming and developing software that is being challenged. So once upon a time, there were such things as literate and structured software development programming, and which then, I suppose, evolved into object-oriented programming. And now we're looking at something called functional programming. Don't worry if this is all over your head. The point is this, developers always like the nice, shiny, brilliant diamonds, always looking for the next best thing. And that may be something like Scala, which is a object functional programming language. It might be Clojure, it might be something like F#, or it might be something funky as Rust. All these are far removed from the generous HTML with CSS and JavaScript and PHP. And even in the PHP world, I suppose things are moving beyond the Symfony frameworks. Not that I'm a PHP expert. Even new ways of thinking of developing software are changing. So I guess 10 years ago, people wouldn't have heard of user experience at all. But it's actually been around since, I guess, the 1980s with Steve Jobs and the Macintosh interfaces. It was human-machine interaction. And now we're looking at voice. Point is, we can't keep adapting and adding plugins and bolting on and boilerplating legacy applications. Eventually, these applications that we write or have written 10 years ago suddenly become susceptible to change, and it might mean the original purveyor of the language or the framework has gone out of business. It might mean that the original chips that the languages or even the bytecode that is running these languages is not available, and therefore I guess in even with economic factors, if IT directors and people who are the decision managers may be tempted to sit on their, I suppose, benches and not do a lot of change. But as they say, change is coming. And I said that software is becoming increasingly complicated. Now, as a contractor, I have really seen the green field. You are brought in as a contractor with expertise to really hit the ground running and also fix problems that somebody wrote in that code or 6 months ago, or to add new features or to remove new features. It's very rare that people build new architectures because people are just, businesses are hardly finding the money in this economic climate to invest in great new software that is guaranteed to be delivered and earn them a profit. In other words, take up an acceptable risk. And consequently, because of the time pressures, there's that word again, with code reviews, peer programming, with all of that good stuff, eventually we are all humans. We don't design or build software 100% efficiently. There's always, you can enforce things with code style, with lots of tabs or margins, or whatever you write, I pretty much guarantee there'll be code there that will have an error or a security violation inside it. I think the worrying thing is that in the future, that we are struggling to write that software that is clean and is simple. Every time now that I look at code, it tends to be deeply integrated and complicated and not straightforward. And I suppose, you know, it takes that enjoyment away. You don't get to even come close or to a tunnel, because you can't actually give, I suppose, reasonable estimates to managers, because they don't understand the software development process unless they were software developers or architects like you. You can only guesstimate or make a guess if you don't understand what the framework and or the library is doing. And so it throws designing and building software, these sort of information technology projects, they are getting more expensive. And I wonder, what are the factors that will cause a business failure? Sorry to end on that unhappy note, but yeah, we ought to be writing clean software, clean with a clean architecture. How we get there is still very much a mystery to the industry. I will stop there. Thank you for listening.
Now, unfortunately, we don't have a huge amount of time left because we've run over a bit, Andy, unsurprisingly. Oh. But I thought this was really good. I mean, the one the aspect of it that really resonated with me was this idea that we're a bit rubbish at communicating the need to address legacy, right? So all of these companies, I mean, all the companies I work for have been around for donkey's years, and they've all got legacy IT systems that are groaning under the weight of their patches and updates and expansions and all the rest of it. And they really need sorting out. But we are so rubbish at communicating that to senior management and communicating the business benefits of dealing with legacy in terms of, you know, time saved in the future, in terms of, you know, the ability to add new functionality, to be more agile as an organization, all of those kinds of things. And we're even terrible at focusing management on the dangers of not addressing legacy, you know, security, vulnerabilities, privacy issues, all of these kinds of things. And I think the problem comes from something that Peter said himself, actually, in his talk. He said at one point, developers are always looking for the next big thing. And I think the problem is that management knows that. They know that developers are always looking for the next shiny thing. And so they're cynical when they when we turn around and say that, oh, we need to replace all this legacy, because they just see it as us wanting to play with some new toy. So I think we need to get much better at dealing with how we present this kind of stuff, these kinds of requests to management, which is what my upcoming workshop is about. Convincing clients.
What a coincidence!
Which is weird, isn't it? But actually, I think by the time this comes out, that has already been and gone. So it's a bit late to promote that now. Damn. So I'm guessing, Andy, you've got nothing of value to add to this one, because it was a very techie one, wasn't it?
It was a bit of a techie one, but very nicely presented, I've got to say, Peter. You made me feel old, though, talking about way back in the 1980s. You know, what a way to make a film.
Well, you are old, so that...
Yeah, I know, there is that. There is that. Yeah. So, no, I thought that was very nicely presented, very nice kind of, very well spoken.
So there you go. That's all he could say about you, Peter, because he didn't understand anything you said. So
no, you see, I can't help it. I can't help it. I'm thick as pig shit.
No, you're not. You're a specialist.
Now, we see, the interesting thing is that, you know, I don't know, I seem to have been able to kind of blag my way through this career for, you know, nearly 20 years. And, you know, I know very, very little about the, you know, the technical background to a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't have computers. You know, when I was at school, we had one video recorder, one VCR for the whole school. And it got, you know, wheeled around on a trolley, and the Jimmies would steal it at the weekend. So, you know, we didn't have a computer department. You know, I never grew up, you know, tinkering with, you know, bits of code, because it was never my thing. But, you know, I like crayons.
So, Andy, are you going to give us a joke to end with?
I've got a couple of jokes, actually. Obviously,
I bet you a tenner they're both Australian related.
Yes, they are both Australian related. And surprisingly, they're both repeatable before the watershed, because most Australian jokes, I think you and I would get into trouble. If, you know, if I was to tell a joke like, for example, how many Australian men does it take to change a light bulb? If I was to say a joke like that, where the answer is none, because it's a woman's job, then you see, we'd be in serious, serious trouble. So I'm not going to tell any jokes like that.
Oh,
I'm going to tell a joke, which is, what kind of music do kangaroos listen to?
What music do kangaroos listen to, Andy?
They listen to hip-hop.
Of course they do.
They do. They do. And I'll save the other joke for when Marcus is on the show.
Okay. Thank you. I can't believe you said that. I'm leaving it in. I'm leaving it in. You can suffer the consequences of your own despicable behaviour.
I didn't tell that joke. That was not the joke I told. I told the joke about kangaroos and hip-hop. I refused to tell the other joke.
Right. So, for everybody else that hasn't turned off because of Andy, I'd just like to remind you that you could submit a talk, because we're still looking for talks, believe it or not. You can submit it at boag.world/season18. We would love to have you on the show. So we've got loads of great talks coming up, but we're always open to more. All right, so that about wraps up for this week. Thank you very much for listening, and join us again soon. Goodbye.
Take care. Bye. Bye.